Right, my first question is,
who do they think they are, releasing us to look after people?
My name is Bronwyn Tarrant.
You've got a nice deep voice there, Bronwyn. It's just right for a podcast.
Our research interviewees and the research that we're looking at isn't all clinical. It's the whole world of nursing.
You're listening to Adventures in Research. I'm Bronwyn Tarrant.
And I'm Amelia Swift.
Right, you should be the co-host, and I've hit record, finally.
Fantastic. Thank you. And can I just say, now that we're recording, it's always a pleasure to see you. I mean, you're the highlight of my working day.
I love it. This is one of my favourite things to do ever.
This was one of the very first episodes we wanted to do when we first talked about this podcast series. We said we wanted to look at how nurses' research affects nurses. Because nursing is a huge stakeholder group, and obviously it's a really challenging career, but it's a very rich and rewarding career. And so Nurses on Nursing sets up this idea of, let's investigate what it's like to be a nurse. Let's investigate what it's like to be a student. Let's investigate what it's like to be a nurse researcher. The brilliant people that do this research are the nurses themselves, and they're bringing their own lived experience to developing research questions to try and improve the lot of nurses, or at least try and understand what it's like to be a nurse and work in these very diverse areas.
So let me tell you a bit about Philippa Marriott, who we'll be listening to. She's done extensive research around the experience of student nurses going out to their first placement. This is a focus of her master's thesis, and it was stimulated by beginning work as a nursing educator and then joining us as a full-time academic at the University of Melbourne, where she was really thinking about what's happening for these students if they can't transition to their first nursing placement with confidence.
This is where we talked to Philippa about why she wanted to do this kind of research, what the question was.
I was the clinical educator for a university here in Melbourne for first year, first placement nursing students. And I witnessed their absolute shock of coming into placement, that I later sort of learned that that was a real theory to practice gap, or I was calling it cognitive dissonance for a long time. They didn't know what to expect. And that learning curve was so huge in the first week and a half to 2 weeks, almost to the point of putting some nursing students off nursing. Initially, I wanted to look at simulated teaching, but it was quite hard to do that because at this university, it's only a 6-week program. So it was quite hard to be able to evaluate a single part of the curriculum. So therefore, I decided to look at their sense of preparedness for their first clinical placement based on just all that they had learned over the first 6 weeks of their nursing.
What do you think, Amelia?
Does she mean a 6-week module?
Yes. So okay. Students have 6 weeks of preparation before they then go out on their first placement.
And the students that Philip is talking about, are they postgraduates coming into a postgraduate nursing program?
Yeah, so they've done an undergraduate, and this is their master's, but it's an entry to practice level. So they're students who've got a bit more maturity about them. And I think oftentimes we overestimate how robust and resilient they might be when thinking about moving into that first placement.
Thank you.
Oh, and then I talk about my friend Arthur and I. We did nursing school together, and we are still friends today, well over 40 years later. And this is 40 years ago, but it's such a clear memory. We were one of the first group to go through a university or a college at that stage. And we were about to do our first placement, and we were sitting in the cath and freaking out about placement, thinking we're going to kill someone. Who do they think they are, releasing us to look after people? This is the most outrageous thing. Is that the kind of, where you were talking about cognitive dissonance, is that the kind of thing you were thinking about?
Yes, I think they'd learned a lot of things in theory. Like, unfortunately here, they don't have the capacity. I don't think we're allowed to shower people. So this was a good example that, and I was on placement and literally this poor nursing student, I said, I'd stay with you. We're going to go and shower this patient together. And I tried day after day and she didn't do it. And one day she even ran under my legs out of the shower, terrified that she was going to have to shower someone. And it took sort of three of us to block the bathroom to keep her in there. Once she'd done it once, she was fine. But it was that first step. Things like they not knowing, they knew how to do a blood pressure, but they didn't know when to do it or why to do it. So there just seemed to be a big gap between the theory side. They were very good at explaining what to do, but then putting a real patient in front of them, they just weren't able to link the two or start doing the skill in real life, basically.
Why does a nurse have to be pinned into a bathroom in order to give a patient a shower. What's going on in there?
She said she'd never seen somebody, a stranger, nude, naked. She didn't know, you know, it was a male, a white male, and she was an international student from Asia, and seeing an old white male Aussie in the shower was just so terrifying for her. And she just didn't know what to do. But once she understood that it's difficult for the patient as well, and we talked about how they felt and how she felt, and I gave her some tips on chit-chatting, like, how old are your grandchildren? And things that I could distract her and the patient, and we got through. But it was just that first step was so terrifying.
Was he wearing thongs?
And how long ago was this? I mean, it sounds like this happened a long time ago, and you've only just finished your research.
Well, I started as a clinical educator about 8 or 9 years ago, and then I decided to do my Master's of Clinical Education. So it's a 3-year program, but due to COVID, the last year bit, my research project had to be delayed this year. There were 16 first-year nursing students participated, and I interviewed in 6 different groups. Because we were doing it over Zoom, we felt that 4 per Zoom was enough to get their experience collectively. And then I re-interviewed them individually once they were on placement. So I was able to, which actually, looking at the literature, that's my study is the only one out there that does like the perceptions of preparedness, and then compares that to see if there's consistency or change once they're on placement.
What she spotted in her research question is that massive transition into clinical practice and really having absolutely zero clue what it's going to be like, and that beautiful description of the student trying to run out of the shower, just, you know, not prepared in the slightest. And I think if you waited until after they've come back from their placement, then they've normalized it, they've socialized into it, they've got over that huge shock of the new, and you probably won't capture as much of the immediacy of their reaction and responses. So I love that she's used her experience of being a clinical educator to know that there's this huge wave of change right at the very beginning of their experience that she wants to capture. That's marvellous. I'm sure she'll be very pleased that I'm impressed with that.
Okay, so what was the difference, not just in time and duration, but also in content between those two time points?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. So our semester period is only it's about 6 to 8 weeks. So 6 weeks of teaching, and then they have to, the students here have to do a preclinical assessment to make sure they're safe to go on practice. So everybody did that, and then I did the focus groups. Some students went on placement the following week. One person went on placement like 2 days later, and other people didn't do their placements until for about 2 to 3 months after the first initial focus group.
What do you think about that as a glitch, or as an obstacle in the research, that there are these very different time points about where placement is in relation to their placement preparation lectures?
I guess it depends how the data looks when she comes to analyse the data, whether she notices any difference between those people who know they're going to have to wait for a much longer period of time and those who are just about ready to go. I'm quite intrigued to know how she organised the focus groups, because you could have organised the focus groups with a mixture of people who are going on placement immediately and those who are going on placement a little bit more in the future. And I do think there may well be differences, because your anticipation builds. The closer you get to the experience, the more intense your anticipation and your anticipatory anxiety will become when it's more real and it's more immediate. So I think having too much of a distance away from the experience will probably dampen down the level of anxiety the students are thinking about and their connection with their, you know, their imagination and what they're thinking about. So it will be really interesting to see if Philip has been able to take that into consideration during the analysis phase.
Yeah, let's have a listen.
And their clinical placement is only 3 weeks, and I made sure to interview them at the end of their second week, beginning of their third. So the sort of the shock had, the reality shock had worn off, and they were able to give me, I felt that their answers would be more balanced and not so emotionally driven. So I waited, but they were still able to reminisce the week before. So I did get lots of experience of shock reality.
So their similarity is that they're all student nurses about to go on their first placement.
But then there's a massive range of differences. And some of those differences are just about how long there is between the focus group and the placement. She's removed some of the differences, maybe intentionally or maybe unintentionally, by saying that the students have to have passed this OSCE before they go and have their focus group. If you're a particularly anxious person, you might not pass your OSCE, or you may have knowledge deficits or skills deficits, and then you wouldn't pass your OSCE.
Exactly.
So I'm just trying to figure out how homogenous or not this group is that she's when she's doing the focus group. And I guess if they've all passed the OSCE, she has limited those who, as you said, she's removed from the sample everyone who's massively anxious or has poor knowledge or poor skills.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's important or not. Yeah.
I love the fact that you're tussling with that, because I think that's really important in research, is to look at the variables, look at the threats to validity, if you like, and then to really examine them. So I really like what you're doing there, just listening to Philip, where you're picking up on all these kinds of things and then not certain about it. But that's what research is that we've got to keep our eyes open for this.
Is the difference between a quantitative objective approach and a qualitative subjective approach, again, where in a quantitative survey type study, I'd want to make sure that there was as much similarity as possible between the groups, and that there was a large enough sample that the randomness of the variability in each group was equally spread between two groups. And so when it came down to doing the analysis, I could factor that in, and I'd be doing all sorts of fancy schmancy stuff to try and make sure that the results I got were just related purely to the experience that the students were having. Whereas in this research, it's really important to consider the differences between the participants, but not worry too greatly about that until later on.
We want to understand this disparity, or understand student nurses' experience of their first placement and how prepared they felt going into placement. They did an OSCE. Is that the thing that they do?
Well, it's not quite an OSCE because they only have to do one. So I called it a preclinical assessment. But yes, in the grand world, it probably would be defined as an OSCE by some people. Yeah.
And some people find that quite anxiety provoking in itself. And then after the OSCE, so you interviewed students who'd successfully passed that clinical exam and had a focus group. Then some went into placement quite quickly, and then others had placement quite later on. So it's holding you honest to your method.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work for you, and holding everything in mind. How did you manage that?
Oh, that's a good question. I did find that a lot of everybody was given the option to do the individual interview. So they didn't have to do it, but pretty much everybody but one student agreed to do it. So I was close to saturation point from the students going on in the early placements. And then the later placements, I only needed to do one or two. So what was slightly disappointing is one of the later placement students going on a later placements actually left the course after the placement. And I didn't interview her, which was very disappointing, because one of the big things is in the literature is this first clinical placement is when we lose people. So if we really want to keep people in the course, it's looking at preparedness for that first clinical placement, because if they have a really bad experience or don't feel supported or don't like people, my goodness me, there was so much discussions around relationships and support was around how nice people were to the students, then they tended to leave the course and leave the profession. So out of the 16, I lost one, and it is just a real shame I didn't get to interview that person. So I didn't do too many interviews in the last block because I was reaching data saturation point by then, so it wasn't too bad. Initially, my interviews, I wanted them to be more open, but I was finding I needed the structure. I needed specific questions because they were so excited to talk to me and I was wanting to know how they went. And part of me was very mindful of my confirmation bias. And I noticed in the very first interview I did, I was almost thinking about the literature and trying to link it. And so to avoid that, I went back to my supervisor's team and we made the the questions very much more structured than originally planned. So therefore, going to those later placements wasn't too bad because it was quite structured.
She's given us like 27 different gems there all in a row. So the first thing that Philip is talking about here is data saturation. Data saturation is when you analyze the interviews as you get them. So you transcribe the interviews and you code them and you look at the data.
And each time you do a new interview, you do the same process and you code it and you analyze it and you add it to that first interview and you keep going. And eventually you get to a point where you don't find anything new in the next interview. And so you've reached this point of data saturation. And theoretically, interviewing 200 more people wouldn't necessarily give you anything different than you've already collected. And that's one of the ways that qualitative researchers make a decision about how many people to include in their sample. She said something else there. I'm just trying to remember. There was three things. There was the
confirmation bias.
Yeah, she talks about confirmation bias, and it made me think about grounded theory. She sounded like she was talking about grounded theory, where you want to stand really outside of the known theory about something. You want to stand outside of that knowledge and learn from what you're seeing in front of you without any preconceived ideas. Because what you're trying to do is build a theory. You're trying to actually create a theory. And so a theory is just a model to describe what we see in front of us, what we're experiencing and what we observe. And if you can build a good model, it will help you to describe that experience so that somebody else will recognize it. They can use your model and they can recognize this experience in a host of other different environments. So this does sound quite like that kind of, I don't want to have any preconceived ideas. I just want to observe and collect together this information and describe it into a recognizable theory.
Talked about an interview schedule for getting the questions. Oh.
One of the things it makes me think of when she talks about an interview schedule is that tension between allowing people to just talk about what's important to them. And she's worried about confirmation bias, and yet she's pinning them down to a list of topics to talk about. It feels to me like a really difficult balancing act, because on the one hand, you're choosing questions because you've decided what information you want from people. You've not decided the answers that you want from them, but you've decided the questions you want to ask them. So you've decided what you want them to talk about. And that means that you are pinning them down a bit. You're not just letting them freewheel and go off in their own direction. And the risk of obviously of letting somebody go off on their own is that they will talk about something that's really not of relevance to you and not of interest to you. I think we ought to explore at some point, maybe not now, but at some point, I think we ought to explore the difficulty between directing people to talk about something and letting them just talk about what they're interested in.
It's about allowing people to free associate completely down a tangent, although that might be so interesting, particularly if you're using a psychoanalytic model, might be so interesting where they go and what things might come out. That might have nothing to do with this really specific issue that Philip is interested in. She wants to understand people's preparedness for placement and how that changes. And free associating won't allow that to happen. Or just go somewhere else.
Yeah. It's always going to be a struggle for me because I just get really interested in what people say. And then we'll both go off down that rabbit hole together. Very dangerous.
This is Adventures in Research, and I'm Bronwyn Tarrant, a mental health nurse from the University of Melbourne. Such an interesting process though, because people who are listening, nurses who are listening to this podcast will say, well, I'm really good at chit-chat. I can go in and I can have an interview. I mean, that's what we do all the time is we interview people. And but it's so interesting that you found that you were able to identify this kind of internal reference point rather than just dealing with the data that you were given. You were kind of skewing it in a way. What questions did you end up with?
I tried to link them as close to the focus groups as possible so I could see the consistency. So the post, the interview questions, once they were on placement, I really opened up with a very broad question as, did you feel as prepared for the clinical placement? And about half of the participants felt they were, and 25% felt they weren't, and 25% felt they were over prepared. So that was quite a good question. It was still qualitative. So even though I'm giving you percentages, that's just it's only had 10 participants. And then I talked about what was helpful in their preparation, what was unhelpful in their preparation. And a lovely question I thought was, if you were to give the nursing department advice on preparation for future students, what would you do? So that was a really nice question because it made them narrow down their reasons it was actually the answers to that question that was quite specific that I was then able to sort of informally go back to the team, the department, and feedback some of those specific areas that the students felt they were lacking.
Interesting that Philip is talking about quantification of qualitative data. So in other words, looking at the importance of a statement being made during an interview, because a lot of people say it. Mm. And I think there's a really interesting thought process going on there. If everybody says it, does it mean it's really important? And if only one person says something, does that make it any less important? What do you think?
That is such a good question, isn't it? And there's so many other contingencies around that too, about who says it and the authority of the informant, if you like. Does that make it important, even though 9 other people didn't mention it?
It makes me really interested to try and remember to ask these questions of other researchers.
Yeah.
Even going to write it down, because I think the qualitative researchers, the really experienced qualitative researchers, will have a good opinion on that.
And this is how research happens. We come up with a question and think, I'm going to ask other people about this question. So I'm just reflecting about how was that one question about if you could give feedback to the nursing department about preparation, and that almost, again, having a sense of almost action research where the students can have input into changing things, and students really seem to have buy-in, the students who were involved.
That's what research does, is it? I mean, good research does that. Research is something that you're interested in, that you have buy-in from the people that you're researching, and then it informs and changes something. I mean, that's the first piece of research, Philippa. That's very impressive, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think what was also good is I was even able to make small changes to their second semester. So, for example, some of the things about being helpful was when clinical educators would demonstrate a skill in full, and then the student knew what it looked like, whereas due to the amount of nursing skills they had to learn before they went on placement, a lot of the time they were being told what to do, and then they had to go away with their peers and work it out themselves. So they got themselves into a bit of a muddle, like, I know I've been told to do the blood pressure cuff here, but they weren't demonstrated it. So then this semester, I fed that down, and we made sure that every single clinical educator demonstrated the skill in real time, and then did it again in like talk aloud method, slowed it right down and talked through it. So that, I think, in itself was really powerful, because it gave them the confidence to do it, whereas I think there was a lot of lack of confidence.
I wonder how the students felt then, that what they'd suggested was enacted, and then for them when they came back. And so that's almost a really valuable experience in the research, isn't it? I've participated, I've given you my time, I've taken some risks here because I'm telling you about things that may or may not reflect on me well. And then you're using this information and you've made a change that I think would be beneficial to me. So I can see there's a positive benefit of taking part in this research, and it might make them think better about research. It might make them think of the utility of research, because they can actually see it making a change that influences or affects them.
That's great. Well, tell me some of the other findings that came out from your study and other things that perhaps you fed back to the department.
We send students on our first clinical placement to subacute settings, which is great, where you get your fundamental nursing skills up, but we also were sending students to palliative care, and we were sending students to a pediatric hospital. Yet we never taught how to look after the care of the dying patient, and all of our teaching was around adults. So comments like, I went to a pediatric hospital, so it'd be very helpful if I'd learned how to look after a pediatric patient. So that was one area just related to content of the curriculum. But the biggest finding was really students didn't have context to their learning. So what I mean by that is there were 16 nursing students in the study. 3 of them had experience in healthcare. They'd worked as a sort of physio, one was a physiotherapist assistant. So they had a context to hospital. They knew roughly how the environment worked. Whereas the others, they'd come from arts background, business background, come straight from school, from science. So their experience of a hospital was broken bones when they were younger, Grey's Anatomy, TikTok, Instagram. but they didn't know how prepared they were, because they didn't know what they were preparing for. And a lot of them were Googling day in the life of a nurse. What does a nurse do? Things like here in Australia, we have enrolled nurses Div 1 nurses, Div 2 nurses, nurse practitioners, ANUMs, NUMs, lots of, same all over the world, lots of different.
And lots of different, I mean, the abbreviations make no sense because they don't say Div 2 on Grey's Anatomy.
No, they don't. They say, pass me that chest tube. So yeah, I think they didn't know how prepared they were because they didn't really know what they're walking into. And in that relationship, I did discover that individual agency made a difference. So there were students that would be like, well, I'm just going to observe. I'm not going to be doing anything. I'm just going to be walking around following someone. And compared to other students going, I'm going to be active. I'm going to give it a go. And depending on where they sat in that focus group of their growth mindset or their motivation or their attitude was reflected in their placement. They tended to. So I think that was really good to highlight that it's not just about the education system. It's also about the,
I think it goes back to their self-talk in that time and what they tell themselves to expect. And I don't know what I'm saying now. I just talk too much sometimes. Yeah. Not being an arrogant learner or a fearful learner, but being a as you say, using a growth mindset and responding to feedback and not being frightened of learning. So it makes a significant change to a student.
It did make a big difference. But I think just going back to the context, things like one student thought that they would be working 9 to 5, and she even, bless her, laughed and was like, well, that just tells me that I know nothing because I thought I was nursing 9 to 5. But it hadn't even dawned on her that it was going to be 7 in the morning till 3:30 in the afternoon and nursing was 24 hours. And another lady student was going to a GEM ward and didn't know what that meant. So they just didn't know what to expect or didn't even know, would they get lunch breaks? Or one girl, they spent a lot of time talking about the type of shoes they would need because they just perceived they would always be on their feet. And they perceived they would be with the patients a lot, and that was quite a shock for some of them, that the actual, particularly with COVID, I think.
It's such a universal concern. Yeah, what really sort of shoes shall I buy?
It really is.
That's what exercises our students before they go out on placement, definitely.
Did anything you get told during your research from your participants surprise you?
I think that I was trying to move into finding out the results.
I had at least three or four out of 16 that were really fearful of being judged on placement based on their culture, race, and gender identity. And that really surprised me. Yeah. One person said, that's my main concern. Who's the person who's going to be helping me, particularly as, I'm from the trans community. Some people worried how patients were going to treat them. Are they going to want someone from their own cultural background looking? But on a positive, no one reported it on placement, but that was a very strong fear, which I think 3 out of 16 is quite a lot. But it didn't eventuate. But it did cause a lot of mental space thinking about it before.
I think this is a really wonderful concept, and it makes me think about the stance of the researcher. So if I had to guess, I would say that Philippa is a white woman.
Yes.
Well, because she didn't automatically think about being other. She didn't automatically go to having that innate sense of how am I going to fit in. She's got the social capital where she feels she belongs in that world. And one of the things that some of my student nurses have been researching, either through literature reviews that they're doing at the moment or through some qualitative research that they've been doing as well, they've been researching this idea of racial discrimination and being other. And so the student nurses themselves describe their own experiences as not quite fitting in, being treated differently. And they also, interestingly, can see a difference in the way that white nurses treat black patients and black nurses treat black patients. And that's not to say there is any racism present, but there is the student nurses who are black suggest that there is a greater level of mutual understanding between a black patient and a black nurse. And they also feel that that's the same between a black nurse and a black student nurse. And so they go into these situations already thinking about that. And what Philip is saying is and so I'm finding that out from my students doing their research. I'm finding out about their sense of being different and their sense of concern about being treated differently and about whether they'll be accepted.
This is the great thing about qualitative research. It kind of, in literature, we'd call intertextuality, how these texts relate to each other. But in research, we don't call it intertextuality. We just call it do we call it something? Or it's just, this reminds me of this other thing that happens in research. And it's just so
I guess the term we're talking about, reflexivity as well, aren't we? That self-awareness of what you bring to the research and how you impact the participant and how you impact the environment, and therefore you will impact the results that you get. And for, as a learning point, this is being able to think about the research in this way. You don't have to know research to be able to wonder and to be able to ask questions, to be able to think, what's happening here? What does that, why does it work that way? What influence is this person going to have? All I'm doing is listening to what Philippa says, and it's sparking off little questions in my head about, oh, I wonder if that made a difference to what the participant said. I wonder if they would have talked differently to somebody else. That's the art of research critical appraisal in one, isn't it? Just having a think.
Yeah. I just loved your phrase then. I'm going to get T-shirts made up saying, you don't have to know research, you just have to wonder. Okay, that's a beautiful phrase. I'm making the T-shirts up.
Back to me being a genius yet again. Who knew?
Centrifugal force, gravity just goes back to Amelia. It's true. Let's hear a tiny one. I'll see if we can hear if she brings up those themes that she came up with. Hmm.
And they were worried, two of them were worried they were going to get racial abuse. She said, I don't mind if they don't want me to look after them, but I just don't know what I'd do if they shouted at me or were rude. But I thought that really surprised me. And they were in different focus groups too. So it wasn't like one said it and another one jumped on, but that definitely surprised me.
I just asked her to reflect on why we were surprised.
I think living in Australia, we're such a multicultural country. You know, I heard, you know, during lockdown, they talked about half the population were first generation Australians and another quarter were second generation Australians. Oh, I might have got them the wrong way around. But the point was a lot of people live here, have family and come from all over the world. So it did surprise me. And I suppose coming from England and being white, I've not experienced it. So there might be some naivety from me too, that I've not experienced it, so it's maybe I don't know that it would be there. But I did find it interesting.
I was going to say, nothing came out about the way that they experienced the first 6 weeks of their course that made them, there was just something embedded in their experience of the first induction into nursing that they thought, oh, well, this is going to happen when I go out there.
It's a very good question. I don't know. I wouldn't want to sort of comment. I don't know. They did do an Indigenous health subject, and they talked a lot about power imbalances with the Indigenous community. So some of them did discuss, would there be other power imbalances with different cultures? So maybe that was a bit of a trigger. They did talk about power imbalances also, which did come up in the literature. Funnily enough, didn't come up in my research, but power imbalances with student nurses sort of being bottom of the pecking order did come up in a lot in the literature, but people didn't express that. They expressed incivility. It was a lovely word I learned when writing up my thesis, you know, being ignored and, you know, dismissed at times or being asked to do tasks that wasn't enhancing their learning, but possibly needing to be doing, like toileting and showering. But even that, it didn't happen on a consistent basis. And that fed into the other biggest thing I found in my research was how important placement relationships were. So if they were paired up with a nurse that was making them being...
There's a helicopter going off, so we'll just wait a moment. It's amazing how much noise a helicopter makes.
This incivility was quite neat. There's actually two studies that came out last year about it, about just being ignored or dismissed. So I guess it does relate a little bit to power imbalances. But the students that did have that experience tended to then stay away from the nurse that might have made them feel that way. I mean, one of the participants actively went and found the nice nurses for all the shifts, and it came up again and again. Students didn't comment on their supervisory nurses or buddy nurses, however you want to. They didn't talk about the type of feedback they gave or their knowledge base or, you know, experiences. It was so much was it about relationships. I felt like this when I was with this nurse, and I felt like this when I was in this nurse. And the students that, there was one student that had an older gentleman that kept telling her to shush all the time for a shift and told her to shush and listen. By the end of the day and a couple of shifts, and they really took a more passive role. That kept coming up. As soon as they weren't with people that weren't supportive or friendly, they stepped back and they became very passive and became very nervous to do things. So suddenly there was even one student that was looking after patients beautifully by herself after the in the third week, and then got with one student that was highly, highly critical and wouldn't let them do anything. And this male student just withdrew and didn't do anything. But it didn't seem to impact his overall experience, because then for the next day, he got to be with someone else who let him flourish and be autonomous and try things. And he said he got his confidence back and was proactive. And it was pretty cool.
Philippa's primary aim in this research was to find out how to better prepare students for placement. But to me, what I'm hearing is we need to prepare the students emotionally to cope with this difficulty in establishing a working relationship with people that maybe aren't overly friendly. And we also, the value of this research to me is absolutely vital for the mentors or the supervisors to hear this and to appreciate how their unintended communications have such a profound influence over the capability of the student or even their self-efficacy or their intention to try something. And we all know it, I think, from being students and from seeing students, how easy it is to be shut down by somebody's negativity. In fact, I know it as I'm a reader in health professional education, you'd think I'd be over that by now, but I still can be absolutely crushed by criticism and be fearful then of trying again. And I think it's beautiful if we can, if this research is going to be shared with those supervisors, and they can appreciate just the power that they have. Just one smile or a kind word is going to make a massive difference, isn't it?
Did you look at a sampling bias, that maybe you were only getting a particular sample of students who did have psychological assets themselves that would allow them to buoy up and to manage the world, and not looking perhaps at a group of students who were less assertive or more full of anxiotropes or those kinds of things?
I just interviewed whoever wanted to be interviewed. I think what was very good was that I had a huge range. There was, out of the 10 I interviewed, 4 of them went to 4 different rural and regional hospitals. The others all went to different metropolitan hospitals. So I had a big variety of hospitals. I think that played in my favor. I think of just understand of the, that sort of brought out that student agency, but definitely I had two students that were possibly less proactive and used terms like bored. I looked over and saw my other peer not doing anything, and that made me feel better, and I just observed it. And I did originally put into one of my themes, growth mindset versus fixed mindset was one of my themes. But interestingly, I changed it about 4 days before I handed my thesis in, because I felt I didn't have enough variety, as you've said. I felt that out of my 10, there was definitely maybe 80% of them were very proactive and 2 not so much. But I didn't feel I haven't had enough, a big enough sample to prove my point. So I changed the theme to individual agency.
So earlier on, Philippa said she reached saturation. But then much later in the process, with a lot more interrogation of the data and a lot more time to analyze it, she's appreciated that there is actually something different to look at here. She could have probed a bit more for trying to find out a bit more from those students about that growth mindset. What does she call it? A growth mindset versus
A fixed mindset.
And so that, I think that's fascinating. And you're always going to get that with qualitative research, I think, that you think you've reached data saturation, but it's not really until you sit down that you notice a spark in there of something. And you think, that's the next direction to go in, because I need to know more about this. But the other thing she said there is, I didn't have enough of that type of information to be able to draw any conclusions from it. It was an idea, but it wasn't fully formed because I only had those 2 participants talking about it. And so we are back in a different way with this idea of quantification of qualitative research. But here she's telling me something different, because she's saying it isn't how many people said it, it's how much they talked about it. It's how much detail did I get about that topic area. So I think she's saying that it's important, even though only one or two people have mentioned it. I can recognize its importance, but I can't fully interrogate it yet because there isn't enough of it. I love that.
Okay, so although you love it, I'm just going to put it out there and say, is that bad research form? Should she have been holding this in mind and interrogated it at the time and worked that, you know, is it just not being thoughtful enough in the research process?
Oh, you're mean.
I've been known to be, but is that, you know, I could imagine it with a particular lens. I mean, I don't believe it, but could people be critique, you know, the people who are not fans of qualitative research, could this be the point of contention where they say, see?
Well, I think it also goes to Philippa's lens and Philippa's stance as a researcher and who Philippa is and how she's seeing the world outside of her. And so it's a very similar thing to not expecting students to lack social capital or be concerned about racism or, and that beautiful word of incivility. I like that word. I'm going to use it in every hour today. So Philippa said, you know, I didn't expect to find this in the data. And here's another thing that she couldn't have expected to see this emerge because she didn't have a preconceived notion of what the results were going to be. And she tried, but it's all the way through this research story, she's telling us, I can't be too mindful about I mustn't lock myself down into what the previous research has done. I need to explore this afresh. I need to come to this without any preconceived ideas.
So in a way, she's working from the growth mindset herself.
Yes. And it's more and more like grounded theory, isn't it? Because of that lack of preconception of what she's going to find. But I don't think it is grounded theory. And I do think she is it's going to be extraordinarily difficult for her to sit outside of her own experience because she works with these students all of the time. Mm. So, yeah.
Which is the same thing that we had with when we listened to Hosu's research before. You know, these were colleagues in the past. So there's that difficulty standing back and observing, being separate from that, which is great because what you've done there is you've, I suppose, managed a threat to validity. That you've actually gone, okay, well, I can't support this robustly and therefore removed it. What would I don't know if they can hear any of that.
I heard you say robustly. Yeah. I think that's something juicy coming up, isn't there?
Yeah, which is great because what you've done there is you've, I suppose, managed a threat to validity. That you've actually gone, okay, well, I can't support this robustly, this theme robustly, and therefore removed it. What were the other themes that clearly were robust that you came up with?
I must tell you that they all had nautical themes. I didn't even mean to do it. I had three main themes that I came up with. One was adjusting and managing a raft of feelings, which was so that was positive feelings. There was definitely students before they went on clinical placement that were happy to go with the flow. They didn't need to know everything. They didn't need to plan everything. They were actually felt they've done all they could and now they were going to just sit back and enjoy it. And one student even said, I really like that I'm going to go on placement and someone else is going to kind of control my learning for a few days. So the positive, the people that really looked forward to placements before they started definitely had more of a mindset of not needing to control everything. They were just happy to go with the flow. And they didn't know if they were prepared or not. That I have to add that one of them didn't think he was prepared, but he was happy to give it a go. And then under the more the negative feelings I had, my theme was I don't have enough knowledge, which is explains what you were feeling in the coffee shop with your peer, like they're real people and I don't know how to do it. Worried about being judged, which I've told you. Quite a number of participants weren't even sure if nursing was for them, which is very interesting. Out of the 16, I'd say maybe 3 or 4 of them didn't think nursing was for them. So that was, is nursing really for me? Once they'd done their placement, except for the one we lost, but one student was adamant. She was totally in. Yeah, she's like, it's me, I'm a nurse already, I love it. Very, very enthusiastic student. And the other two were still sitting on the fence. You know, I'm still not 100%, but I'm happy to give it a go. But that was because of the ward they were on. So they got enough of a taster, enough of a bite to keep going, but they recognized if they were going to be a nurse, they didn't want to work in the area, they'd just done their placement. And then the fourth negative emotion related to being before placement was being a burden. That was a huge thing. They were so worried that they would be a burden and an extra responsibility. And that tied in with, well, one student said, we're bound to, oh, here we are. If we end up being a burden to them, it's an extra responsibility for them on top of their day, then we might not be treated so well.
So we're still listening to Philippa Mario talking about her research regarding student nurses, where she's starting to try to demystify to students what a nurse is.
So they acknowledged that they were a burden, felt a burden, but they also were worried how that would impact they were being treated. A couple of them had already planned to apologize for their existence before they'd even started placement. They were going to open up with, I'm sorry, I don't know anything and I'm going to be a burden.
I love this idea that students are receiving the workload associated with them being taught, and simultaneously they're all thinking about their entitlement to education. So there's this, when at the beginning of this interview that you were doing with Philippa, you both talked about cognitive dissonance, and I didn't understand why you were talking about cognitive dissonance at the beginning. I didn't get the relationship between that phrase and the work that Philippa was doing, but that beautifully expresses that the students can hold in their heads these two very, very different notions. On the one hand, I'm entitled to be educated, and on the other hand, I don't want to be a burden. And it just beautifully illustrates that idea of how difficult it is to navigate this territory as a student. I love nursing research.
And I was thinking, I hope that the students who are listening to this are being able to say, yes, that's exactly what it's like.
Maybe we'll find out in our focus groups.
Or maybe they'll put this episode on social media and go, hey, I've just heard a podcast that really nails how we feel about placement the first time.
5 to 7 days had gone. The majority of them had flipped. They'd become more active. Their confidence had gone up, and then they didn't feel so much of a burden. So that was my first theme around feelings. My second nautical theme was sinking or swimming, which was looking at, that was around the perceived expectations. So that was what got me into this study in the first place, as I've talked to you about the theory to practice gap. And that really was translation to practice is overwhelming, which ties in with all of the literature. You know, it's a big jump. They're learning it, the theory part, now they've got to jump. I've talked to you about the growth mindset or individual agency. And then that contextual learning. I had two beautiful students. One said they were a musician, and when they learned a song, they would listen to the song in full. Then they would go and break it down. And they described the course as learning all the chords, but they didn't know the song, and they didn't know the rhythm, and they didn't know how it was played, so they couldn't pull it all together. So they had all the notes, but they couldn't pull the song together. Another one was like, I've got all the jigsaw pieces, but I don't know what the picture is. So they couldn't pull it together. So there were some really lovely
analogies. I love that. Oh my God, that was so such a fantastic way of
describing it. They are just gold,
isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what it all looks like. And then we expect somebody to just jump in there and get on with it, don't we?
And then my third theme, which I've told you already, was the reality of navigating placement relationships. So the literature really talks about belongingness, and the sense of belongingness in a team was really important. That didn't come about so much. It was the individual relationships. One reason I wonder if the belongingness didn't come about so much was because it was only a 3-week placement. And what I've read, you know, they were really just so focused on individual learning skills, where they were at. They hadn't looked at the bigger team yet, maybe, but that would have to be something to be looked at in the future. But the collegiality was big. I wasn't expecting, which I feel quite naive saying it, I wasn't expecting the importance of peer relationships to be as strong. The students that were rurally or regionally on their own felt really isolated. They didn't know if what they were experiencing was normal. They didn't know how it compared. They didn't even know they just didn't know what other people were doing, and it made them feel, I think it really gave them a lot of stress, and almost made them feel a bit left out.
because the groups, there's 8 students go out at once in the metropolitan hospitals, and a lot of them, they'd made their own WhatsApp group or their own messenger group, and they could talk to each other, be it if it was just like, can't find the car park, one of them said, and they got told. So for those ones on their own, there was a huge amount of isolation. So when they had a really bad shift with someone not being nice, as simple as that, it really impacted their experience. Yeah.
Rural and regional in Australia. Can you explain to what rural is and what regional is in Australian context, so people overseas will understand what it's like?
Sure. The reason I'm laughing is because my supervisor, I'd been writing rural, and my supervisors were writing, is it rural or regional? And I was like, I don't know. And so this was I had to contact a lot of people to get the definitive difference. So regional tends to be, I guess, larger towns in Victoria. So I think it's based on population, isn't it, Bronwyn? So if they're a big town, it's classed as regional. But if it was a small, sort of like a small country town, or in England we had called them village hospitals, they were classed as rural. So some of the hospitals were actually classified under the rural regional trust, but they were so far away from anybody that two of them were classified as rural.
I'm Amelia Swift, and this is Adventures in Research.
And when the student nurses go to rural locations to do their practice, do they need to stay overnight in that area? So they live away from home?
They live away from home for 3 weeks. And most often the hospital organises accommodation. So they can either move in with a family, so be billeted, or they get a room at the nurse's quarters or whatever it might be still. Because it can be up to 6 hours.
So that's that's really interesting about the context in which this, about the students are speaking. That's going to be really important in Philippa's report to make this accessible to an international audience. You have to recognise just how different your experience is to somebody else's experience. And so most of the nursing students in the United Kingdom will commute daily to their placement area, and it will be less than 2 hours in almost every case, usually less than an hour's commute in either direction. And in Birmingham, our commute's, quite short for most of our placement areas. In other areas of the United Kingdom, the students do have to go and stay. There'd probably be several of them going to that location. So in this case, it might be one student going to a remote location on their own.
Yep.
And that's got to heighten your fear and your anticipatory anxiety and everything else, hasn't it? So I think it's interesting that it didn't dawn on me until now that was an important context to listen to this research report in.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's about where you shine your light when you're listening, isn't it, or looking at the data.
Mm.
And certainly, so the rural placements, because they are smaller hospitals, they can't take as many students, whereas a regional can take more. And because they have more patients and they're more of an epicenter. And of course, in the metropolitan ones, the students are going there and going home every day.
And when we're talking about distances, just so people can get an idea, because Australia's quite big, how far away from Melbourne were these students going for their rural placement?
Anything up to 3.5 hours away. They couldn't commute. They were having to go there and stay in accommodation. And there would often be, some of them were isolated. It was sort of like almost a small room with a kitchenette. Some of the accommodation rurally is a houses, but thanks to COVID, they weren't allowed to do it. So everybody had to be in their own little unit, self-contained unit. So that added to a bit of isolation.
As a researcher, what was the high point and the low point in this process for you?
I really enjoyed doing the focus groups. I found I did really enjoy it. I really enjoyed watching the students have many light bulb moments, like, I'm feeling that too, and I've never told anybody. So I really enjoyed the focus groups. I actually found them easier to facilitate, and I found the interviews quite difficult. I had a couple of students that would talk a lot, which is great, but I wasn't almost able to keep up with the talking and my questions. And because I'd changed it to be quite structured, I found they would talk and then I'd go back, and it was getting a bit repetitive. And And then I had students that were very quiet, and trying to get more out of them was really difficult. And I learned that I then talked too much and I should have had more silences. I think there's definitely looking at, technically it's insider research. So for people that don't know that, I was working in the department and I'm interviewing the same people. So I wasn't teaching them. I was managing their clinical placements and working in the labs. But I think they trusted me. So I think that made a really big difference. But at the same time, one focus group, they all just kept thanking me and telling me how great my colleagues were. And I had to kind of ignore it to get them to not tell me what they thought I wanted to hear. So it was a really big learning curve. I said, didn't know 901 times.
Hang on, was it actually 901 times? You're just making that number up.
Some of the students that are doing, some of our students are doing their qualitative research at the moment, and they're interviewing either other students or nurses about different topics. And they're finding it much easier to have two of them in each interview. So one of them does the interview and the other one takes notes, but also makes notes of follow-up questions and things, so that the person is actually doing the interview can really fully focus on what the person is saying to them. And what they've discovered is, if they're doing an interview without that second person, then while the participant is talking to them, they're thinking about their next question. They're thinking, oh, I've got to ask that next. And so they're not really attending to what the person's saying. And as a consequence, they're missing important stuff. And when they come to transcribe it later, they go, how did I miss that? How did I not know they were talking about that amazing thing there? And it's because they were just distracted thinking about the next question. And that's one of the reasons I think that doing research is a really, really important way of learning about research, because until you've had a go at that, we can listen to Philippa describing that situation, but I think when you've had a go at it and it hits you how difficult it is to do as a skill, you're like, okay, right, I'm getting it now.
One of my students was very, very emotionally distressed, which I actually had to escalate that as per my ethics.
You had a distress protocol.
Just describe it to me. What is a distress protocol?
Okay, so I'm on a greater than minimal risk ethics committee. And one of the things that I'm really very attuned to is, as researchers, oftentimes we're so focused on getting the information and finding our way through that they don't really fully understand what that might be like for the participants or for the relatives of the participants or other people around. And the distress protocol is about what I will do if somebody is becoming distressed. So as a researcher, do I stop the interview, or do I provide some time, or do we have people come up with a whole variety of different things, but a distress protocol that I think is the most robust, and often they're written by psychologists, but they're about really, the researcher will do one, if B, the researcher will do two, if A and B, the researcher will do three. And it very clearly sets out what to do and what to say. So it's very structured. And I think in part because, as we were just talking about, when you're in research or just listening to the moment, you may not be thinking with that other part of your head about what to do when. So the distress protocol is really about keeping the participant very safe and managing their distress and being really fully aware that it's voluntary. We want to hear, but they can stop at any time and that's okay. And here are the support services. And we can take a break, and to really help people modulate their emotions and be safe to talk.
Maybe we shouldn't do research on people if it might upset them.
Mm. And that's when you have to think about the benefits versus the risks and really justify, is this research worthwhile? And my early research is around a construct I developed called traumatic countertransference narrative, whereby listening to people talk about their trauma can, or even not even talk about their trauma, but have something quite distressing and you can tell they're distressed, you can feel that distress and what that process is like. So it's a really interesting area and sometimes not given full weight at what needs to be ethically done.
I think we also have to remember though that each participant has autonomy. And if a person has mental capacity and can make a decision whether to participate in the research or not, then they, as long as they appreciate it, could be very tricky conversations, it might raise distress, it might cause them emotional distress, then they have every right to participate in that. They have the right to choose to participate in that. And I think that illustrates how nursing research cannot be paternalistic. You have to give the information to people and allow them to make a free choice about whether they want to take part or not. As long as they appreciate how valuable the information they give will be, and therefore you have to have an output, you have to have a direction that this is going to go in, and you have to be able to demonstrate that the results of this research are going to be used in this particular way. And you can't be what I often find myself as, is a person who doesn't finish things. If you use people's time and you potentially cause them harm during that, you better do what you said you were going to do. You better finish the job.
Yeah. And further for me on that, which is absolutely true, is we have a duty of fulfilling our part of the contract, I suppose, if they're entering into an ethics, they're signing an ethics, being a plain language statement saying, I understand, is that I've forgotten what I was going to say. Rewind. Oh, member checking. I think that a member check is so important, to say to the person, this is what I heard whilst when you were talking to me in this really open and honest way.
Absolutely.
The focus groups were a highlight.
The interviews were hard.
I found a coding. I'd never done that before. So coding, you come up with your themes and then you find quotes to fit into the theme. So I had 533 codes. And initially reading through, that was quite a process to pull out.
533 codes?
Yeah. Pages and pages and pages, but yes. So each focus group was an hour, so that's 6 hours of focus groups and then 5 hours of interviews. So
that's a lot of data, and that explains to people also who are listening. I'll do qual because I just have to talk to people. Qualitative research is really difficult. I mean, the amount of, you must know those transcripts really well now.
I do. So once I got the themes, because I was initially basing my themes on the literature research that I'd done. So that's how it started. And then I realized that things weren't fitting in. It was a bit like getting a triangle into a square hole. So I then had
to. So you kind of changed your methodology in a sense, in the way of being going from theory to applying that somewhere, to then going, well, there goes the theory, and being more grounded or responding to what you were getting. And going for saturation that way.
Yeah, well, I was just...
Would you describe it as phenomenological then?
I have had it described as phenomenological. Yeah, but it is classified as a descriptive qualitative study. But I think my four themes that came out of the literature was about cognitive dissonance, belongingness, power imbalances, and the hidden curriculum. But power imbalances didn't really come up. The hidden curriculum didn't come up. Oh, and anxiety, as you can imagine, it was rife. So there were similar things, but I just, I think what was good about this study is it, when all the other studies that I'd read about perception of preparedness, they haven't been on there. So they were never able to know if they were prepared. They were almost preparing for something they didn't know that was happening. So to be able to interview them after and say, well, were you prepared? Did you... and some of them, as I've said yes, some of them said no. But it then meant that they could actually tangibly reflect on where they were before. And so then you could see the difference.
Wow. So this is groundbreaking. No, seriously, as your first piece of significant research into nurses, you've been able to influence and change curriculum, feedback and inform curriculum design, and actually contribute to the broader knowledge around postgraduate entry to practice nursing course.
She's contributed to the knowledge base around nursing preparedness. Just in the same way that HOSU, first piece of research, had really, really contributed to understanding this difficulty of retention of nurses in specific eating disorder units, with both being, presented internationally and getting publications and changing systems. And I was just really impressed by these two young nursing researchers coming up with such powerful outcomes.
Both of them are
experienced in their fields, aren't they? So they're novice researchers, but experienced nurses and experienced educators. I think in nursing, we have tended to delay getting our start in research until we are fully mature as a professional. And that's not how it's going to be in the future if I have my way. I think nurses will start sooner and do more research, more practically based research.
We're asking everyone what advice they would give to nurses considering doing nursing research, perhaps even those nurses who think, that's not for me, I'd never do it. What advice would you give to them?
I have really enjoyed it. I have really enjoyed it, and it's made me understand the process. And I think that is really important. You know, suddenly I will pick up an academic paper and now I'm like, I read it through a different lens because I can understand what they've done, the back end of it. So I think that's a really valuable tool. And I think it's really nice for us nurses, you know, we're big picture people, you know, we might work in ED and be an expert at a jack of all trades, or we might become experts in oncology in one specific area. But I think having a focus on one area, I did really enjoy it. And I really, I learned so much from my supervisors, which I sometimes think as a nurse, you're left finding a mentor or finding role models in nursing can be quite difficult because the areas are so broad. And so I think in a weird way, they were my supervisors, but they also mentored me in the process. And academic writing, I thought I was pretty good at academic writing before this, but they just refined it and refined it and refined it. So just the satisfaction of, you know, I genuinely think I've done as good as I could have done. It's just open. It's been good. Give it a go.
Fantastic. And I just realised we haven't introduced you. One of the things I'd like to say, so you're Philippa Marriott, you work at the University of Melbourne. Your area of clinical expertise, and how long have you been a nurse for?
I graduated 2001 from Kingston University and St George's Hospital in London, and then I went really straight into cardiac, and then I've been doing cardiac or ED since. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time, Philippa. It's been tremendous hearing about your research.
It's been such a delight listening to your interviews that you did with Philippa and Hosu. And it just has demonstrated to me how broad the field of nursing research is. And that's something there for everybody. If you're an educator, if you're a mental health nurse, and we've got Cara representing the adult nurses, we've talked about end of life care, we've talked about eating disorders, and we've talked about student nurses going into practice for the very first time. And all of those different pieces of research are about nurses looking at what it's like to be a nurse. And it's so different. It's fantastic.
So stay tuned, listen to the next episode.
Absolutely, when we decide what it is. Brain's gone a bit fried now.